This is these are four 27-year-olds. The kid on the right had 3 years business experience, which was more than the other three founders combined when we started the company. The guy with the beard is Bill Joy, who I consider the inventor of open source. He was basically the chief architect of Berkeley Unix, which was, we were really the Red Hat of Berkeley Unix back before anybody kind of understood or knew what that meant. Al Gore said he invented the internet. We think we invented open source. And I really give Bill Joy credit for being kind of the father of open source and did the first major open source project out there. Andy Bechtolsheim is the guy in the red sweater. Andreas von Bechtolsheim came from Germany and invented the Stanford University Network workstation while at Stanford. And was one of our co-founders, so we had the Sun workstation kind of design that he brought from Stanford, and then the Berkeley software distribution. So we had a choice between Stanford University Network or Berkeley University Network, and we figured Bun Microsystems would not be an appropriate logo, so we went with Sun instead of Bun. And then Vinod Khosla on the left was from Delhi, with the Indian Institute of Technology, Carnegie Mellon, and I met him at Stanford in business school. And we became good buddies, and the four of us went off and started Sun in 1982. Interestingly enough, there is no major multi-billion dollar R&D technology company that has started since we did. We were the last one, if you will. The barrier to entry, the scale, the scope, building an intellectual patent portfolio has been very, very hard to go do post-1982. I would say Google might be an exception to that, and we can talk about that. That's kind of a new entrant into the computing environment, and if you ask Microsoft, who scares them to death? Google scares them to death. But anyhow, That's the gang that got this thing started, and we're now about 35,000 employees worldwide. We do about 60% of our revenue outside of the U.S., and again, about $14 billion of revenue. We started off doing workstations. Those are the early designs. And I can remember the first computers had 256K of memory. Huge at that time. That's huge. That's how old I am. How did we do it? Well, if you're going to go off and do your own startup, my suggestion is you better be controversial. And we've always been controversial at Sun, but as you develop your strategies and you take it to people, if they think you're nuts, you might have something. If everybody thinks what you're doing is the right thing to go do, you have no chance, because if everybody does it, you can't differentiate. It's like going into an interview and saying, I breathe. So the deal is you gotta have a differentiation. You gotta be controversial differentiation so nobody else is doing it. Because if you have differentiation, then you have pricing power. If you have pricing power, then you can make money. If you have no differentiation, you have no pricing power, you're going to have no chance of making money. Now, the real hard part is being controversial and correct. That's the hard part, that correct thing. You got to be right. And I can't help you there. You're going to have to find a really smart bunch of folks and come up with some really good ideas. And there are still really good ideas. I wish I had thought of auctioning off every word every day to all advertisers. I didn't think of that. I remember when the first spreadsheet came out, I thought, why didn't I think of that? You know, there's lots of stuff that hasn't been plunked up yet. So think about it, go for it. Again, don't worry about controversial. That's a good thing. My other piece of advice, and I won't give out too much, you know, there's a lot of folks out there who just thought they'd take a shortcut ethically, morally, legally. Just don't bother. Those shortcuts don't make any sense. They will come back and bite you. And I know you probably have whole classes in how to be honest and ethical, but you all know, just do the right thing and pay attention, and long term you'll stay out of jail. That's a good thing. Let me kind of start at the top about what is Sun all about. You know, most companies start off with, oh, we're here to be number one or number two in the industry, or we're here to put a PC on everybody's desk, or, you know, everybody has their own little mission or whatever. We actually start a little higher up. We think every organization ought to have a cause. And the causes matter. Ours is to eliminate the digital divide. It may surprise some of you, but 3/4 of the world is not connected to the IP network. Think about that. 3/4 of the world is not connected in any way, shape, or form. In fact, they don't even make phone calls. That's kind of hard to believe. You kind of lose track of it here in London, but there is this world out there that is totally not connected. And our goal is to connect all of these folks. We don't think it's going to be done by hooking them all up to a mainframe. And we don't think it's necessarily going to be done by one laptop per child. I don't think there are enough system administrators in the world. And I'm not sure we want all of these folks who are emerging out of poverty to be spending all their time being a personal mainframe administrator, managing their own file systems and clusters and arrays and level one, level two caches and kernels and patches and upgrades and all the rest of it. In fact, the big device opportunity to get everybody connected is the Java phone. This is the thin client that's going to connect everybody. And if you look and go into these developing geographies and nations, the number one way people are getting on the network for the first time is this. It's how they're browsing, it's how they're communicating, it's how they're storing cash, it's how they're banking, how they're getting educated. And I think if you go around the world, people give up their PC way quicker than they'll give up their cell phone. And so our goal is, you know, the network is the computer. You might have heard that phrase. We've been talking about that for a long time, is to provide a network computing model that's not like a mainframe or not like a PC. The worldwide community's access. We want to do it without harming the planet. Imagine we turned on a mainframe access for every human on the planet. We'd be about 6 feet underwater, even up here, if we did that. There's just not enough energy on the planet and air conditioning on the planet. There's not enough floor space. We think we can do this with very eco-responsible computing strategies. I'll talk about one of them later in this chat. But anyhow, that's our cause. Now, we have a fairly unique strategy. We share. We spend a couple $1 billion of R&D every year. To give you a little understanding of how big or small that is, there's only 42 companies in the world who do more R&D than Sun. And that includes all the pharmaceutical, aerospace, technology, automobile companies, all the rest of it. So we're right up there in terms of R&D companies. Now, we do a really dumb thing with our R&D. We share it. We open source it. All of our software is either open source or being open source. We even open source our microprocessors. I have the fastest microprocessor on the planet in my pocket, the OpenSpark T2. Fastest and most energy efficient. So it's like a hybrid that is the fastest dragster on the planet. And we've open sourced it. So we're not open sourcing Russian trucks. We're open sourcing, sorry for all the Russians, don't throw anything in the room. We're open sourcing the best stuff in the world. And we've been doing this, as I mentioned, since 1982. A lot of you are too young to remember, but we took open source TCP/IP back when Microsoft was pushing LAN Manager. DEC was pushing DECnet. Remember DEC? No, I'll tell you no. Trust me, 25 years ago, that was the big monster out there. Apollo was pushing domain. Novell was pushing IPX, which was the hot networking protocol back then. And IBM was bringing you token ring. So only the old timers are laughing at this. It's kind of fun to think about history. We were the first company to put TCP/IP on every computer we ever shipped. And look at what won. And look at the Unix community development, the Java community process. I'm going to run one more experiment here. I've been doing this everywhere I've been going. It's been kind of fun. How many of you in this room, some employees are not allowed to raise their hand. How many of you use OpenOffice or StarOffice in this room? Just raise your hand. There you go. It looks like about half. Maybe a little less than half. That's actually a little less than, say, at Ecole Polytechnique, which I was at earlier this year. They were somewhere between 50 and 75%. So they're a little more progressive than you all are. Well, I'm here. That was my friend. So everywhere I go, that number is growing. And I was with the German library, all the research and academic library. They were at 50 to 75% are using OpenOffice, StarOffice. So what that tells me is you all have too much money. Because you can afford Office, which OpenOffice is free. And you can share it with your buddies for free. But this model is taking off, and it's a big deal. We're working very aggressively, and we have provided all of our software for free to the university. It's not an exclusive gift, but I like to make it sound that way. It sounds aggressive. You just go to our website, click download, and go get a cup of Java, and come back, and there it is, free. Did I mention free? Plus, we have very aggressive academic pricing for all of our equipment. Plus, we have network.com, which I'll talk about a little bit later, which allows you to actually use this stuff. But we're doing joint research. We've got a sunspot. Julia's doing a sunspot thing on the, what are they called, the church's bells, or the Queen's bells?
Queen's Tower.
Queen's Tower with the bells and all the rest of it, and see how the place jiggles when the bells go off. So that'll be interesting. See how that all works out, but there's lots of very interesting research projects that we are doing and we should be doing with you all. We also announced the Campus Ambassador Program. Are there any campus ambassadors here in the room? Ready to see these folks? If you want to know anything about Sun, check it out, track them down. How will they find you? Is there going to be a website or something? There's a website for Campus Ambassador, a community website. I don't know what it is, but yeah, we'll hopefully be very vocal, and they will be able to give you access to any technology and access to any Sun gurus that you need so that you can learn and take advantage of, did I mention, free open source Sun technology. So we are infiltrating the campus. We have folks on the inside now, so watch out. Open standards matter, and part of the challenge here of IT, and one of the things that we've done, unfortunately, in our industry, is we have many written and spoken languages for computing. Now, each geography tends to standardize on one language, which is a good thing, and it allows a lot more communication. And the written and spoken language is very enabling. You imagine you're not allowed to use written and spoken. It'd be hard to teach, for instance, without the written and spoken language. The written and spoken language of computing is becoming equally fundamental and enabling. Yet, unlike English, which nobody owns the alphabet, nobody owns 0 through 9, nobody owns grammar, syntax, addition, subtraction, addition, division and multiplication, and words. The written and spoken language of computing is privately owned, privately licensed, privately charged for, and privately enforced through our patent and intellectual property law. And I find that unfortunate, because it is so fundamentally enabling and so critical to bridging the digital divide. I mean, imagine there was the verbal divide. Some people who were allowed to speak and others who weren't. And imagine we were trying to find a lower cost way to allow everyone to speak. Do you see how ridiculous that sounds? But that's where we are in the written and spoken languages, which is why we've taken it upon ourselves to open source and to say, let's get to a standard. Let's pick a side of the road to drive on. We don't need competing standards. Why don't we have a lingua franca for written and spoken? Can you imagine tomorrow the government declares, we're going to have a little competition. Should we drive on the right or the left-hand side of the road? Everybody choose a side tomorrow. Let's see Darwinian, you know, reality at work. Let's see who wins. Right? And then we'll just, there's at point, you know, at some point it makes sense to choose something. That, and nobody has to pay extra unless you're in downtown London to drive on the left. By the way, that system runs on Sun equipment. So. So anyhow, standards matter, and we're certainly trying to suggest a standard. And one of the things I'm offering to the government of the UK, to the government of China, to the government of France, the government of Germany, I'm not bothering with our own government because the U.S. loves the U.S. monopoly. There's a reason. We have inheritance taxes, we have income taxes, we have capital gains taxes, and everybody around the world who pays taxes on those proprietary written and spoken languages of databases and mainframes and desktop operating systems, and all of you who didn't raise your hand about open office, thank you for funding the schools and the roads that my children use every day. On behalf of every U.S. citizen, thank you. Very nice of you to pay those taxes. So the U.S. doesn't care, but the rest of the world, we have gifted a complete written and spoken language for computing. It is a very complete set of IP for building out the infrastructure for an open standard volume written and spoken language of computing. It includes open sourcing the microprocessor. And in fact, there's already one startup here in the UK called Simply Risk that downloaded. There's like 6,200 downloads of UltraSpark T1 already, and Simply Risk is a startup that took a bunch of kids, took this code, started a company, away they go. There's one in China called Polaris that's doing the same thing. You too can download and create a derivative. It was interesting, we were talking to the Metropolitan Police this morning about your activity. No, not about your activity. They had their own unique encryption scheme, and they got very excited when we said they could take, they love UltraSpark, but they wanted their own cryptographic schema on this. And we said, just go work with a local chip company, download the design, and add in your own cryptographic scheme, and build the chip, and you can have your own, because they don't like to use the cryptography that the U.S. supplies, right? That bugged them. I don't understand why, but we wouldn't cheat. I promise. So the point is, we've got the operating system with Open Solaris. We've got the middleware stack with the Java Web Services stack. We've got the developer tools. We've got the Glassfish app server. And we just announced this week the open source virtualization suite, XVM, with a new open source community around that. We've got all the storage architecture in there. You could run a Google service on this stack. You could run an eBay. You could run a supercomputer grid. You can run whatever you want on this IP and pay Sun exactly zero. Interesting. So why doesn't the UK all decide to drive on the Spark Solaris Java NetBeans open office side of the road? Why not? Why doesn't the college? Well, colleges, urban cats, the government's not in charge. But it might be interesting to watch China decide that this is the way they want to go. How'd you like to compete against all of China, which has grabbed all of this IP and decided that's the written spoken language. Anyhow, we're making this offer, it's there. I'm not sure anybody will take it. Lots of people are. We just left British Petroleum. They said they stopped doing Linux. That's a legacy environment. They're doing Open Solaris and Windows. Those are their two platforms. They're kind of diametrically opposed, but on average, they're kind of average. There you have it. So anyhow, that's the gift, and that's the proposal for an open UK from an IT perspective. And as again, how crazy is that idea? Don't worry about us. We're 19 straight years cash flow positive operation, even though we're open sourcing our IT. We think it's a good idea. These are the major communities. This chart was done at the beginning of this week, and we've got to add the open XVM virtualization community that we've added for all of our virtualization software built on top of Xen and other technologies that we're bringing to the party. So again, this is, did I mention free? There's another way to use our technology besides hitting the download button. And you might have heard the phrase, the network is the computer. Well, so you can remember this website, www.network.com. Go to the website, try it out. We've now been allowed to export this. For a while, we had this running internally in the US, but the Defense Department thought it was some sort of weapon of mass destruction. So, and you know, you guys are just sort of allies here. Really. Yeah. So we're now able to expose network.com, which is a supercomputer at network.com. You can just use it. It's $1 per CPU hour, and with the exchange rate, that's like stealing. And all you need is a PayPal account to go use it. And you can run whatever you want on a Sun supercomputer grid for as long as you want. So get some of your professor's grant money and set up a PayPal account and go crazy. Do whatever you want on network.com. We're going to ultimately expose all of our software on this site, do all our downloads, patches, upgrades, remote monitoring management, and allow you to develop. So if you want to do a startup and you don't want to buy any computers, just use network.com, develop your software on it, and you can ultimately deploy your service without ever having to buy hardware. And we'll just keep enough hardware in front of you as you grow your business so that you don't ever have to buy a data center. Have no depreciation. You don't know what depreciation is, go take an accounting class, get out of the lab, and understand that, because if you're going to start a business, you need to know what that means. But that's the model, and it is the utility compute model and where we're all headed. Now, if you do want to build a data center, I just want to share with you an interesting idea that we came up with. And my frustration in the computer world is that everybody's building their own custom Frankenstein data center. And if you go travel to any business and say, can I see your data center, the CIO will proudly take you into their data center. And they'll show you something that is made out of 40 different body parts. There will be an Oracle, whatchamacallit, a Novell this, a Veritas that, an EMC, hoochamajiggy, IBM, whatchamacallit, and there'll be all these different body parts. And they don't have bolts sticking out like this, have big scar. It'll lurch around like this. And there'll be IBM Global Services with shock paddles ready to shock this sucker to life because, it, you know, pieces are dying and obsolete and getting upgraded. And it's ugly. And they always walk in and say, you got to see. And they hand me their baby and they go, what do you think? And I go, oh, that's one ugly baby. But I can't really tell them that because they're the customer. And so I said to my engineers, I said, why is... are our customers doing this? And they said, well, I don't know. And they really don't, because engineers go out and buy 10-speed bicycles and they pay extra to have them unassembled. Any of you resemble that comment? So I explained it to them. I said, well, if you give somebody landing gear, ailerons, and a fuselage, they're going to build an airplane. If you gave them the airplane, maybe they wouldn't build the airplane. So why don't we give them a bigger chunk of the grid? And So I said, go away and tell me what's the biggest hunk of grid computing you can ship to the customer. So they went out and they built a really big one, but then they couldn't figure out how to ship it. Because they couldn't, you know, like helicopter freighter it there or anything like that. And they had to get it through the door. So they went out and they got a shipping container and they said, this is the biggest single unit of shipping, standard unit of shipping. How much computing can we stick into a shipping container? And they said, well, 8 racks fit very nicely, 4 on each side. There's just magically enough room in the center aisle to slide the racks out for maintenance and assembly. So just magically, a shipping container is 3 racks wide. Lucky, that was just a lucky thing that happened. So they said, well, once they got it all stuffed in there, and you can see it stuffed in there, they go, how do we get it out at the customer site? Should we put rollers on or little rails, or how do we get it out? And then they thought, you know, that's more work than just leaving it in the container. The container's only $3,500. And they're coming over from China full with nowhere to go empty. So they're cheaper than that. So they said, let's just leave it in there. So we put shock absorbers under the racks for shipping. We put fire suppression, power distribution into it. And then we have to cool it. We all know data center issues around cooling. So they said, let's line them up for me and let's run the airflow around like this. So magically, they found out that it's 20% more efficient by running this airflow around in the cyclonic manner in the data center. Because if you put a server in a data center today, the first thing you do is you blow the air up from the holes in the floor. And it goes every, well, the first board is like this, has icicles hanging on to it. But the next board's up here like this. The airflow goes off that way, and it goes everywhere but on the hot chip. So you've got one frozen board, and the rest are all glowing red. And it's very inefficient. We're 20% more energy efficient, 20% less carbon footprint. We're carefully baffling the air around. So we put a cold water radiator right next to the rack. It sucks the air through and blows right across the horizontal blades, right into another vertical radiator, and around like this. Very efficient, very quiet in these things. Unlike if you've ever been in a data center, the roar that goes on, your hair goes 48 ways. So that was a nice innovation. The second innovation that was, and by the way, all of a sudden now there's a big car park, a big, it's like big chunks of computing, and the customer is out of my kitchen. Right? All you do is add cold water, network, and power to these devices. No assembly required. There's the cold water, and you can see the fans there. And this is what the inside looks like, very clean. You don't really want to hang out in there, but you can if you want. The lights are out, it's all bolted shut. And they're pretty easy to move around. In fact, moving them anywhere you want, and you can locate them in lots of different places. Now you think, holy mackerel, you got that outside. I mean, that's actually a pretty harsh environment. They go across the ocean. They're weatherproof. They are sealed, hermetically sealed. They're very safe environments that way. You'll have your PlayStation 3 in a shipping container on the top of a boat coming all the way across the Atlantic or Pacific, through the North Sea, all kinds of weird places. So it certainly saves you a lot of money. The boss doesn't even park their car there. They can go anywhere. But this is the new data center, and this is the warehouse with holes in the roof. It doesn't matter if it leaks. It turns out building a data center out like this costs about $500 a square foot versus the Class A around like $2,100 a square foot. So better than 4-to-1 cost savings. And you get one other big win here, a couple other big wins that are kind of unintended consequences of just building these bigger hunks of computing. And that is, you can put the data center by the power station. The reason you put an extension cord from the power station right into this warehouse. Why? 7 to 50% of power is lost in transmission. So we've already taken 20% of the carbon footprint out of the data center, and 40% of the cost of running a data center is power. Now we take another 7 to 50% out. Plus, we've taken out over 75% of the cost of the data center itself. Plus, we've eliminated the customer assembly of Frankenstein. Now, all of this was just because I told them I'm tired of the customer building these little parts. The other win is 99.99% of the power outages are the electrical grid, not the power station. So by having an extension, your extension cord will never fail. So that if you do have a grid failure, you just keep running. But the grid and the power station, or the power station goes down, then you go out on the grid and find another power station. And if both go down, you've got a Katrina problem, and then you use your diesel generator to power your data center. So incremental, enormous changes. And again, this is how we're going to bridge the digital divide. We've got a Russian customer, I can't say exactly who it is, but are buying these black boxes in volume now because, you know what, in Russia they can't afford to build a Class A data center, and they are distributing this kind of computing power in very strange places. I wanted to rush through one more idea to get you all thinking about how the network works. You're all familiar with Wikipedia. What Wikipedia is to encyclopedias, Kuriki is to K-12 educational materials. This is a nonprofit. Kim and I started this Inside the Sun. We spun it out last year as a nonprofit. We're raising money from a bunch of companies, like O'Reilly companies, Bechtel, Nortel, Sun, and other companies are funding this. And we're talking to a bunch of the big foundations. And I've even talked to Bill Gates about this. And his educational foundation, I believe they will support this effort. What we want to do is have free and open source K-12 educational materials. That means the textbooks, the self-paced browser-based online curriculum, the test materials, and the assessment tools for every class you'd want to take in K-12. Online, self-paced, on-demand, free, open source, community engineered, peer-reviewed, as well as academic board reviewed, as well as certified by any particular school district or national curriculum evaluator group. Now, think about this. Self-paced, wouldn't that be cool? A lot of you would have gotten through primary and secondary school a lot faster if you hadn't had to wait. I had one class at Harvard back in the olden days that was self-paced computer online. With statistics, I started Monday morning, I was done Tuesday night, hadn't eaten, slept, or showered. I got an A, I bugged the professor at all hours of the night, but I got it done. If Harvard had been online, I'd have gotten done in 18 weeks, and Jobs, Gates, and Ballmer wouldn't have gotten this huge head start on me. So imagine your experience was online and self-paced. Imagine you could get feedback and find out what you're good at versus other kids your age, as opposed to all this self-esteem thing that you're developing nicely, which is what the report cards say today. Imagine we could make it interactive, fun, and online, and like a video game. When was the last time you, remember when you play a video game, you stand up screaming, you're hollering, and yelling, and going nuts? When was the last time you did that with a textbook? Why can't we add gaming and instant feedback? Why wouldn't we play a video game? And when they're losing, a little gopher pops up and goes, nah, 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 you're losing, loser, loser, you know? And the kids get a big giggle out of that, and then you want to kill that thing, right? But they don't run away from it. They want to try harder, and they want to keep practicing until they get it right. We want to have that kind of experience online. And imagine we have a reference architecture for third grade math, and you say, I got a better chapter four. We can give half the students chapter four control, half the students chapter four prime. And we'll find out with statistical significance very quickly which one scores better. And we can evolve the reference architecture in a free and open source way for everyone. And you think, free, what's the big deal? We spend $4.3 billion a year in the United States. $4.3 billion a year, every year, just for textbooks. Nothing's changed since Newton got hit on the head with an apple, yet we gratuitously revised a $100 third grade math textbook every 4 years, so we have to buy new ones. Think about taking the cost out of the system. And you know what? India can't afford $4.3 billion worth of textbooks. And so there's going to be this is a private strategy to help eliminate the digital divide and provide a reason for people to get online. Anyhow, just using the sharing open source concept that we learned at Sun and applying it to another opportunity. So as you feel free to go online and donate via PayPal if you'd like. All donations are accepted, and I think anything that the Imperial College would like to donate in terms of curriculum, academic review board support, anything like that would certainly be accepted, because I think this is a very, very exciting opportunity. You know, I think we're just starting. Someday we're going to get the bulk of the planet online and have a very, very interesting strategy, and I hope we're all speaking the same open, free, unencumbered written and spoken language of computing, because I think that will drive a lot better understanding and help us bridge the digital divide. So anyhow, I'm a raging capitalist. I sound sort of unlike that, but this is, I believe capitalism creates a very nice byproduct, and that's an improved standard of living for all. And that's why we're doing what we're doing around sharing. We think that's the right way to drive the market economy. So I'm kind of a contradiction, but it's controversial. I didn't name my first kid Maverick, so there you go. So that's my prepared speech. I'd love to answer any questions, comments, thoughts, suggestions, or whatever from any of you on any topic. I'm happy to go wherever you want to go with this conversation. Yes?
Do you think DLM has a future?
Do I think?
DLM has a future.
Do I think DRM has a future? Digital rights management. You know, that's a complicated story. Every time somebody comes up with a DRM strategy, some tenured professor and a couple of Russian mathematicians figure out how to debug it. So you can spend a couple billion dollars creating the DRM strategy, and, you know, Apple tried to keep the iPhone as a closed proprietary environment. They've already found ways to hack and program iPhones. Then Apple tries to turn it off and all. I mean, I think that's kind of whack-a-mole. You know, you get the mole over here and he pops up over there somewhere else. I think if I were creating intellectual property content, I would rather ride the internet wave than try and fight the wave and keep it secret and proprietary. And But then again, we'll support whatever the studios want to go do. You know, it used to be studio content was, you know, the bulk of the kind of fixed content out on the internet. Now, user-generated content is 99% of the content out on, and studio content doesn't matter. You're all watching YouTube more than you're watching TV these days. And open source content is actually being leveraged by musicians around the world who fundamentally don't need to go through the publishers and recording studios and the record labels. They just put their stuff out on the internet and away they go. And the way they monetize being free on the internet is they have to go to a concert. I mean, the fact that Madonna can't necessarily make all her money by sitting back and collecting royalties, and she every now and then has to actually go out and do a concert, that, I don't think that's the worst thing that could ever happen, that she actually has to go out and sing a little bit live. But, you know, there's cost to all of this stuff, and there's advantages to all of this stuff. I just think DRM is really hard to stay ahead of the game, because there's always faster computers that are going to crack the code. Now, if you can come up with the magical, uncrackable DRM that's zero cost to implement and guaranteed to work and will work on all appliances, you know, that could be bigger than Google. But I don't know anybody who's figured out how to do that yet. I do know folks who spent a lot of money on DRM and then had it cracked in a matter of minutes. And there goes all that work. And the solution is always published free and open source on the web. And you know, once that's gone on, you can't, like the words, you can't grab them, stick them back in your mouth. They are gone. Which always fascinates me about why you all put all your stuff on Facebook and MySpace and all these other things. You know, it's funny, I was in Germany. They are so, you know, focused on privacy. Yet I think about all the kids putting, you know, all these pictures they shouldn't be putting up on their own resume. I call it a digital tattoo. I think they think if they delete it, it's gone. But it ain't. There's the Wayback Machine. If you have never visited the Wayback Machine, I can go back. And when I'm interviewing you, I can go back to your senior year, look up what you had on Facebook, and find out what was really going on. You know, I don't know. Yes.
If you're giving all this technology and research away for free, then what does Sun look like as a company 10, 20, 30 years from now? Does it become a services company? Does it become IBM?
So, free sounds hard to monetize, but Google has certainly figured out how to make money on free. Right? Google's free, but they monetize the advertising places. So our free is the software and the IP. What's not free is the server storage and services and switching technology that is used to make the software go. Now, we aren't an exclusive supplier, so we'll never operate at outrageous margins, but we do okay. Like I said, my kids have nice shoes. So the real question is, do we sell servers down the road, or do we wholesale network.com to BT and to Vodafone and to AT&T and others, where we own and operate the site? And then they retail it and offer it through their billing engine, or do we go direct? Or do people keep still buying airplanes, or keep buying airplane parts? I mean, our vision may be wrong. We may still be selling piston rings forever and having people build their own Frankenstein. But our guess is it'll be closer to us. I really look at IBM and Sun as kind of the Boeing and Airbus of the industry. Everybody else will be component suppliers to us or to people who want to build their own custom airplanes. But the world will really kind of settle down to Boeing and Airbus. And I don't want to be in the airline business. I want to be in the airplane design and manufacture and support business. And I think the telephone companies will become the equivalent of British Airways and provide service utilizing our airplane with their billing engines and their networks to go deliver access to our grid. Or, you know, there will be six grids out there operated by independent service providers and will be armed suppliers to them. Greg Papadopoulos talks about how the world's going to get down to six computers. And that doesn't sound too ridiculous when you think that there were 8 million servers sold last year, all make shapes, sizes, colors, brands, you name it, 8 million. We think Google bought 1.5 million of them. That's like 1/6 right there. So there could be a massive consolidation now. One thing I can guarantee is we don't really know 15, 20, 30 years from now. And you know, Sun is gonna try and stay as flexible. We started off as a workstation company, so we will evolve and morph and take advantage of the opportunities depending on how they present themselves. And the industry doesn't always do the right thing. I mean, why isn't the automobile long enough to drive sideways up onto a rail car so that you can do very quick on-off onto rail cars, and when you want to drive somewhere, you drive to the local train station, drive up onto a docking station on a train and drive away. Well, the problem is you have to drive on lengthwise, which is a very hard problem to solve on trains, and it isn't quick on it. So we didn't do that right. I mean, if we had to go back and do it all over again, we'd have made the rails a little bit wider. Wouldn't have cost that much back before we built everything up. But we didn't know about the automobile, did we? So, you know, we don't always do things the right way, so I can't guarantee that the right logical answer will apply in the computer industry. Certainly, I would argue that the computer industry is more screwed up than any industry in the world right now, given all the problems I identified, except for healthcare, which kills everybody eventually. So the bar is pretty low, and we can only get more organized as we go forward. Yeah.
prefer that the open source, the open handset alliance released the OpenAPK, and they use a Java language, but they do not actually use any of the Java virtual machines. They use their own Delta virtual machine to completely sidestep SAN and take any licensing fees for the open handset.
So the question is, the new Google Open Handset Alliance is using its own implemented Java virtual machine, so they don't have to pay anything to Sun. We open source Java, you don't have to pay anything to us. We're just thrilled to death that they're speaking Java. And we think that's a wonderful thing, and the bigger the Java-speaking community on the planet, the better chance they will have of, we're not making money on handsets, that's not our business, that's not our game. We want a Java browser enable everything. We look at a car as a Java browser with tires. We look at a plane as a Java browser that can fly. And a phone is nothing more than a Java browser that you can text and send phone messages from. And so the fact that they're doing that, I don't care if they send us any money, that's not the deal. But if there's a Java client out there, there's a very good chance they'll need some Sun servers on the back end, Sun storage, Sun switching technology, and maybe some Sun support. And maybe network.com becomes a great back end for all of those Java phones. So we're thrilled to death. That's not our monetization model. The client appliance monetization strategy is not part of our, that's our free. That's the whole idea. And I think if Java wasn't open sourced and free, you know, that alliance probably wouldn't want to speak Java. They might want to invent some other new language and put us back even further in terms of eliminating the digital divide. So exactly the right things are happening, and we're thrilled to death.
So you state that Sun is a big supporter of open source, which is really, but what took you so much time to open source Java, Visual Machine?
So the question is, why so long to open source Java? The reason is we wanted to make sure that the promise of Java, which is write once, run anywhere, and the Java security model and the Java brand were firmly established, and they are now with 6 billion devices out there. We had a little problem early on with a Java player, partner, who took the Java class libraries and deleted some of them, and then took some Windows system calls and labeled them .java class calls, and started proliferating that on desktops everywhere. So what happened was people would write to their Java virtual machine, and they would see these Java class libraries and write to them thinking that they were in every Java virtual machine, but actually they were Windows calls. And then when they went to run their application on a non Microsoft VM, it didn't work because those system calls didn't exist. And if they wrote their application using a standard Java virtual machine and then they went to run it on the Windows VM, some Java calls were missing and their application would crash in that case. And the write once, run anywhere promise is a huge problem. And you have that problem in Linux. Not every Linux app runs on every Linux kernel. And in fact, you don't have binary compatibility from Linux to Linux within one release. We wanted to establish the security model. Name a Java virus. 6 billion devices, name a Java virus. And to protect the write once, run anywhere, and to drive the button. Now we took this company to court, we won, got paid damages. And now Microsoft sends everybody to the Sun website for a Java virtual machine. That's how we protect that architecture. And I can guarantee you the Google VM or the Open Alliance VM will follow the security model and will follow the API, the write once, run anywhere environment, or it will be rejected because 6 billion other users will just say not interested if it isn't compatible. So now it's safe to go ahead and open source. Sometimes there's required a little benevolent stewardship early on in the life of an architecture to go make sure that it gets enough escape velocity so that when it goes ballistic, it's in orbit as opposed to come crashing to the ground. So that's why we did it. There was never, and by the way, Java was open source all the way. every Java Community Process member, which is about 1,000 corporations, all had access. There were millions of engineers who had access to the Java code all throughout the process. It just wasn't open source in the conventional wisdom sense. It was the most community developed product in the history of ubiquity. So now it is in name and in reality too, but it's always in reality that open source. One more question, Aurelio.
The common products that you mentioned, you're definitely late to the party. So with the network.com and the company.com security and your virtualization, there's obviously your own products out there, free virtualization. Is this a different strategy, trying to see where the market goes, or is this just too slow?
The question is, we're late to the market with some products, like Amazon's out there with storage on demand, and other people have virtualization products. We only have $2 billion R&D, not $2 trillion. We're first to market in a whole bunch of areas, and we're followers in other areas, but we're always first with open. Because other people aren't doing this stuff with indemnification, meaning we will take the intellectual property hit if somebody thinks that we're stepping on their intellectual property. And we're not going to invent all of the great ideas. We didn't invent TCP/IP, but we were the first company to put it on every computer and popularize it. We were the first with NFS. But you know what? We didn't take advantage of that. And NetApp actually created the NFS filer market and won that market big time. So there, back in the old days, we were the first out with a volume router, the original routing protocols for the internet all ran on SunOS back in the early days. We didn't recognize Cisco. And Cisco went out and created, I should have gotten fired about 20 times for the mistakes I missed. But we also got there first and early with some great things like CMT and with the Java Virtual Machine and containers on Unix and that sort of thing. So we weren't the first with containers, but we really kind of drove the market with Solaris. ZFS is a brand new technology nobody else has. Our chip multi-threading is we're first to the market with. So we're first in some things, and then if we don't get to be first, we're not proud. We'll be second, but we'll open source it and drive it. So you can argue we're not ahead of the game on every front, and that's true. Of course, neither is IBM. I mean, name one thing that Microsoft invented. Name one. I'm waiting. Yeah. They bought or borrowed. That doesn't necessarily mean success either. But I would say Sun has more than its fair share of innovation in Spark, Solaris, Java, NetBeans, and all the rest of it. Anyhow, I would love to enlist all of you with the ambassadors here, the Sun ambassadors on campus here. And when you go do your startup, call us. We'll give you some really inexpensive equipment. And the software is free. Did I mention free? We'd like you to develop the next Google in the written and spoken language of the communities with which we're supporting out in the open source world. And if I can help in any way, scott.mcneely@sun.com. Happy to help. I won't get to your email probably till Monday. So there you go. Thanks a lot.